is VOA Asia Weekend. For the next hour, you'll hear some of the top stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The U.S. Justice Department says it will pursue the extradition of the chief financial officer of China's Huawei Technology Company Limited, arrested in Canada in December. The United States has accused Meng Wanzhou of misrepresenting the company's links to a firm that tried to sell equipment to Iran despite U.S. sanctions. The arrest soured ties between Canada and China, which subsequently detained two Canadians and sentenced a third to death. Paul Evans is a professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It was in that city that Meng Wanzhou was detained by Canada at the request of the United States. I asked Professor Evans if the announcement by the United States that it will go through with extradition surprised him.
I don't think it is surprising. There's been a lot of momentum behind this in some quarters in the United States. And the real issue is not just is the request proceeding and that the documents will be submitted by January 30th, the deadline. But I think the issue is what exactly the case is going to be, how strong a case it's going to be, and how far it fits with the specific terms of the extradition treaty, which relate to having the equivalent of the offense in Canada. And that's going to be an interesting legal issue. And how, I guess the fundamental question is how strong a case is going to be presented at this stage. And that we just have to wait and see. If it isn't a strong case, this may be a situation in which a Canadian judge would reject it.
What kind of evidence could there be? What, beside being arrested in Vancouver, has she done in Canada?
Well, nothing. And that's an important issue because the warrant against her was issued by a court in New York City for activities that took place in Hong Kong in alleged misrepresentation to bankers. So nothing has happened in Canada. But the question is whether those specific activities in Hong Kong could have been, if a Canadian were doing the same thing, would we act on that basis? Would they be violating Canadian law? And there my lawyer colleagues tell me it's a pretty complex answer, partly because of how we connected into the sanctions against Iran in a somewhat different way than the United States. And also because as you mentioned, this was not this was extraterritorial to Canada, and it's the U.S. that's pushing for extraterritorial application of its laws.
It has been said over and over again that Canada is between a rock and a hard place between China and the United States, leading to a letter that has been sent to Chinese leadership by some very respected people asking for something to happen.
I think the background to this is that in this dispute between Canada and China that has escalated rhetorically and in terms of started with the detentions, that there's a number of Canadians who are very upset by this, and that what the Canadian government has done is in this bilateral spat with China aimed to internationalize it. The Canadian government has called on the United States and several other countries, including the EU group, to express their dissatisfaction with the arrest of the two Canadians. So that started with the government level. What this is about is a number of people international. Less than a third of the signatories are Canadian. But it's several countries, including the United States. And across what I might call ideological boundaries, there's conservatives, there's liberals of various persuasions who have entered into this, and they feel that there has to be an international expression of concern, because not just for the two Canadians there, but it risks the kinds of connections in China that a lot of researchers try to establish, and they're the kind of people who are often the best interpreters of China, the most fair-minded and informed. So, Ira, we're in a difficult, the letters in its intention is a good one. Whether or not the call for an immediate release is reasonable, whether in fact it's going to harden Chinese positions on that, that's something that we're debating privately. But the letter itself may be a constructive part of the bigger discussion on how we're going to end this standoff between China and Canada.
Meanwhile, Canada's ambassador to China uttered similar thoughts to a group of Chinese journalists gathered outside of the Canadian capital of Ottawa Wednesday. John McCallum spoke to CBC News about his comments about the case that might very well be presented by Meng Wanzhao's attorneys.
I think she has quite good arguments on her side. One, political involvement by comments from Donald Trump in her case. Two, there's an extraterritorial aspect to her case. And three, there's the issue of Iran sanctions, which are involved in her case, and Canada does not sign on to these Iran sanctions. So I think she has some strong arguments that she can make before a judge.
We have attempted to get reaction to this story from the United States Justice Department. We have yet to receive a reply. An Australian newspaper reports that a Chinese-Australian writer and dissident has been detained during a visit to his native country. The Sydney Morning Herald says Yang Hengjun was detained by security agents Friday in the southern city of Guangzhou after arriving with his wife and her child after a flight from New York. The family was set to catch a connecting flight to Shanghai, but Yang was not allowed to continue. Yang is a former Chinese diplomat turned democracy activist and novelist. His detention in China occurs during the detention of two Canadian nationals in China in apparent retaliation for the arrest of the Chinese telecom giant Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhao in Canada. Australian college professor Feng Zhongyi says he believes Yang's detention is directly related to that case.
The current situation that he was detained or arrested, I believe, is directly linked to the Huawei case. I see his arrest as the extension of Chinese hostage diplomacy, to take him as a hostage to pledge the Australian government and Canadian government, American government, or the government of democracies around the world.
Yang may be the latest in a string of activists and human rights lawyers who have been detained in a sweeping crackdown on dissidents since President Xi Jinping took power in 2012. China's foreign ministry spokeswoman said Wednesday she had no understanding of the situation and would speak to relevant agencies about the matter. Iowa soybean farmers are among those in the U.S. agricultural sector who are being hurt by the trade war between Washington and Beijing. As the two nations accuse each other of unfair trade practices, demand and prices for soybeans are falling, worrying American farmers that Chinese market will turn to suppliers in other countries. However, farmers in Iowa are hoping the close personal and commercial relationships they've developed in China over the years will help them weather the storm. Reporters Kala Yu and Suli Yi from VOA's Chinese service went to Iowa and filed this report, narrated by Brian Kamzinski.
Iowa grows huge quantities of high-quality soybeans, much of which has been going to China. Iowa farmers use a lot of equipment and land to grow and harvest the soybean crop. But resources, sweat, and skill are not enough to make money, says David Miller, who planted 153 hectares of soybeans but earned no profit in 2018. He says the tough U.S. stand has cost him money, but is forcing China to bargain.
But without the tariffs, has China paid any attention to the talks?
Chinese President Xi Jinping has in the past visited Iowa farmers to boost trade and personal ties. Former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, who is U.S. ambassador to Beijing, has done similar work on the Chinese side. But trade ties between the two nations are strained as Washington accuses China of market manipulation intellectual property theft, and other trade obstacles. China has dismissed the U.S. accusations. After Washington slapped tariffs on Chinese exports and Beijing reacted by imposing tariffs on American farm products, Iowa soybeans became more expensive for customers. So demand for American soybeans plunged. But Grant Kimberly of the Iowa Soybean Association hopes China's growing wealth may make it easier to make a deal.
China needs soybeans. I mean, they need soybeans because their middle class has grown. That means they're eating more protein in their diet, more meat. And if you have more meat production, you have to have more soybeans to feed those animals.
But China is already importing soybeans from Brazil and other nations. U.S. experts also worry the impasse could encourage Chinese farmers to boost soybean production or use corn or other substitutes for livestock feed, putting a permanent dent in demand for U.S. farm exports and farmers' incomes. For Kala Yu and Suli Yi reporting from Iowa, this is Brian Kopczynski, VOA News.
We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The third annual Women's March on Washington attracted a smaller turnout than the original event in 2017, held just one day after President Donald Trump's inauguration. But Saturday's event was no less rollicking as women and men marched through the nation's capital amid considerable controversy leading up to the rally. VOA Asia's Anna Cook has the story.
Donald Trump has got to go!
Braving winter winds and cold rain, thousands of men and women across the nation gathered in the streets of Washington to champion issues ranging from the partial government shutdown and the president's border wall to women's reproductive rights and gender equality. Mia Ives-Rubley, a transracial Korean-American woman who is disabled, has been involved in planning this year's march and says she is fighting to gain more rights for all of her identities.
My hope, you know, is to continue to talk about how these different identities interact, how we can support each other, and how it's so important that we are able to talk about disability, especially in the Asian American communities.
Compared to previous years, organizers say this year's march is different because they are pushing ahead with a solid agenda.
Really specific policy demands, and that's, of course, the women's agenda that we released yesterday. It was crafted by a policy table of about 50 to 70 women, movement experts, policy experts from really all backgrounds.
The recent dispute surrounding the leaders of the Women's March regarding allegations of anti-Semitism didn't prevent some women from turning out to support the demonstration.
I'm actually a Jewish Israeli, and I know that it's controversial for people like me to be here today because of all the controversy surrounding the Women's March, but I'm not giving up my seat at the table, and I'm here to make sure that anti-Semitism is something that is addressed and part of the Women's March agenda.
Even with a record amount of women elected into Congress, both men and women here say that there is still much more to be accomplished.
So I was crying like when I heard that they all got like put in, and I was just so happy, but like we still gotta make the moves. We have so many firsts now, and I'm just so happy about that, but like we still gotta bring the punches. We got some work left, yeah.
Everybody supports women. It's not just the people being oppressed. It's all of us. This is one community, one voice. If you are going to trample on their rights, even though they're not me, that's still important to me.
In addition to Washington's rally, sister marches took place in multiple cities across the country, including New York and Los Angeles, and across the world. Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
As the partial U.S. government shutdown continued and hundreds of thousands of workers were furloughed or working without pay, the impact was reaching people across the nation. VOA's Mariama Diallo had the story.
What do we want?
Federal workers across the country say they've had enough.
What do we want? Pay! When do we want it?
Now!
Some families who say they've never had to depend on donations are turning to food banks for help. Even students who rely on free or reduced fee meals at school are impacted. One North Carolina school announcing lunch menus are being revised to conserve food and funding. The Lambert family are worried about feeding their 5- and 6-year-olds.
The sooner they can do something about it, the better it'll be for us low-income families.
In California, TSA union leaders say this shutdown has gone way too long. In Washington, families letting Congress know It's time to reconcile their differences.
I've pawned everything that I can imagine, and now I'm just at my wit's end.
As the shutdown drags on, some businesses are also taking a hit. Mohamed Bada has been operating his falafel food truck in the District of Columbia since 2014. He says the ongoing shutdown has drastically cut down his sales.
Usually I do in this area, I do like 60, 70 customers. So far, maybe I did like 19 customers today. Especially this week, it's really, really, really bad.
Bada, who owns two food trucks, can now afford to run only one. He says if sales don't pick up soon, he won't be back next week and will look for another job instead. Meanwhile, there is no budging on either Democratic or Republican side. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, a new form of social therapy is powering on in the U.S. A group of former toy company employees bought a brand from their ex-employer and started developing robotic household animals that serve as friends and therapy aids to America's growing elderly population. More from Arash Arabasati.
Helen Nicholas moved to Florida with her family in the 1990s. Before that, she owned restaurants near Chicago.
My mom was real good with finances, balancing her checkbook. She came in to see me one day with a check. You go, Mike, what do I do with this? What do you do with this? Mom, it's your check. Well, okay, what do I do? And that I started realizing something's going on here.
Doctors diagnosed her with Alzheimer's disease in 2012. In recent months, she has gotten a new form of social therapy. Nicholas is one of a number of elderly people across the country suffering from brain disorders who now spend their days with man-made pets. They are the creations of a group of former Hasbro employees. They purchased a division from their toy giant, former employer, and now develop robotic household animals for the elderly. Caregivers say interaction with the pets can change lives.
The stimulation is keeping everyone animated, keeping everyone socially engaged with each other because they're with their peers. And you can't ever undervalue the relationship with your peers.
And caregivers say the pets bring joy to their patients.
Even though it's robotic and it's a toy, it's not seen as that by our residents. It's seen as a dog.
Alzheimer's affects an estimated 5.7 million Americans. It is a degenerative disease that robs a person of the ability to think. With these animals, at least for a short time each day, patients get to relax and enjoy the moment with a furry friend. Arash Arabasati, VOA News.
Rising temperatures, changing rainfall, and encroaching diseases are threatening the world's coffee crops. A new study says many of coffee's wild relatives, which could help the crop adapt to a warmer world, are also at risk. More from VOA's Steve Barragona.
It's a really long way to go for coffee. But the coffee these scientists are looking for, you won't find at your local cafe. This is a rare wild relative that grows in the jungles of Sierra Leone. Coffee has 124 of these cousins across tropical Africa and Asia. But 60% of the family is at risk of extinction, says Aaron Davis, head of coffee research at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew.
So the main threat to the world's coffee species is deforestation. And that's because most coffee species actually occur in forests.
Those forest species may fight off diseases better than domesticated coffees, or they may do better in a drought, or they may tolerate higher temperatures better. Davis says those traits are increasingly important as the planet heats up.
The species we grow occur in very narrow climatic envelopes. That means that as the climate changes, as temperatures increase and rainfall decreases, the suitable area for growing this coffee diminishes.
That means trouble for coffee-producing countries, where the bean is a major source of income. An estimated 100 million small farmers worldwide grow coffee. Climate change threatens wild coffee, too. That's why Davis and his colleagues are searching the jungles for them now.
We don't want to be in a situation where we find ourselves requiring some wild plant or some wild genes, only to find that actually it's extinct in the wild.
Davis and colleagues say there's no time to waste. Their new study found nearly half of all coffee species are absent from the world's seed banks. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Muslims in the southern Philippines voted Monday in a referendum on a new autonomous region that seeks to end nearly half a century of unrest in what their leaders are touting as the best alternative to a new wave of Islamic State group-inspired militants. I spoke via Skype about the referendum with Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor.
This has been brewing for hundreds of years. In some ways, the issue in the southern Philippines, in that when you think about the Philippines, the southern Philippines has primarily been a Muslim region. The northern Philippines has been a Christian Catholic region. The Bangso Moro issue was a problem for Spanish colonization. It was a problem for American ownership or occupation of the Philippines. And it has continued to be an issue that has divided the Philippines in its modern era. And it has spawned militancy, it has spawned terrorism, and it has spawned violence. And the vote that we're seeing taking place today is the culmination of multiple phases of trying to come to terms with the interest groups in the southern Philippines and bring them more actively into both the governance of the southern Philippines and into a peaceful relationship within the entire country.
So what does this entail? We remember back, I think it was 2017, that troops, including a U.S. or an Australian surveillance, routed the militants who occupied Marawi for 5 months, and it left more than 1,200 people, most of them Islamic fighters, dead. So what happened after that? I mean, how did we come to today?
In previous peace accords, there was an agreement to create the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao, which had some local governance, and that had been a deal with the Moro National Liberation Front, which was a different group that was related to the current MILF. They had created a certain element of local governance within the southern Philippines, but that had not ended large-scale militancy. Then the government worked first in competition and in conflict with, and then in a peace accord with the MILF to create this space for this vote for expanding the construct of what was the ARMM into now what will be the ARMM. But the Marawi incident was one that fit within this context. That was a smaller group. It was a splinter group off of some of the other militancies and some of the other sub-ethnic groups within there. It was inspired and connected to the Islamic State. And one of the things that we see with these larger Muslim, formerly militant groups in the southern Philippines is they're looking for some way to create economic benefits for their people. And that means that this is the government of the Philippines working with these larger militant organizations to try to control some of these smaller terrorist groups like we saw in Marawi City.
So if this passes, goes into effect, as we are led to believe will happen when the vote count comes out in the next few days or so, what happens?
Well, if it passes, and right now it's looking cautiously positive that it will pass, this creates a need for a new round of elections, for an expanded organization within the southern Philippines to be able to have some element of autonomous power over economic development, over social policies within the southern Philippines. And then there's going to be a question, if this vote passes, for a few other parts of the southern Philippines to decide if they want to join this new broadened entity. The challenge for the Philippines is going to be to get the different interest groups within the southern Philippines to agree and to cooperate and to come up with an agreement that not everybody is going to get exactly what they want in any new election. There are interest elements that have established themselves under the ARMM, and they are quite happy with where they're at. New entities, new individuals are going to have some greater share in that power. And that's probably going to be what we're going to be watching for next is, yes, there's some space for some calming of the broader tensions within the southern Philippines. Now we're ideally pushing into more of a political rather than a militant process.
How safe is this? Some Western governments, although they're welcoming the pact, we understand, they worry that some IS-linked militants from the Middle East and Southeast Asia could forge an alliance with these Filipino insurgents and turn the South into a breeding ground for extremists?
I think that that's a slightly unfounded risk. What we've seen in the southern Philippines, what we've seen through Indonesia, through Malaysia, is that in fact, Al-Qaeda and IS have had a difficult time establishing broad-based links within those areas. The development of Islam in those areas in Southeast Asia was very different than we've seen in some other parts of the world, in the Middle East in particular. And so, yes, there are aspects within the southern Philippines that may be open to that ideology, that may be seeking to link in and connect into it, that may allow for a continuation of certain elements of militancy and terrorism. But the ability to connect to a broad-based movement within that space doesn't necessarily seem to fit the cultural and social patterns of Islam as it's developed in the southern Philippines.
Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. China has been waging a movement against Christian churches, recently arresting Pastor Wang Yi and members of his unregistered or underground Early Rain Covenant Church in the southwest city of Chengdu. Human Rights Watch said the December shutdown of the Protestant church epitomizes what it called President Xi Jinping's relentless assault on religious freedom in China. It said the church, including a kindergarten, offices, seminary, and Bible college, were ransacked and sealed, private homes searched, and some members beaten. Wang Yi was charged with inciting subversion of state power. The rights group described the pastor as an outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party. Ian Johnson is a Beijing-based writer for such publications as The New York Times and has authored the book The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, a reference to China's Communist Party founder Mao Zedong. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that Beijing embarked on a crackdown on religious groups 2 years ago with new regulations that tighten control of religious life.
There is this religious revival going on in China, and to some degree the government thinks that it can be useful for the government as a way of building values and binding people together in society. But on the other hand, they're worried that religion can become a force that's outside of government control. So they have these new regulations in place and have been slowly tightening the screws on groups that are not registered with the government, that are independent of government control. And this is probably the most prominent church in China that is not registered with the government. And so it was almost just a matter of time before they went after it.
What happens to these people once they're detained? Are they kept incarcerated for a long period of time?
Most of them are detained for 24 hours. The police has the right to detain people for 24 hours. There have been some reports and photos that have been circulated on social media that seem to show that people were roughed up a bit. And basically, they're meant to be scared a little bit and then released. And then the government will, however, go after the leaders of the church. Wang Yi, to my knowledge, is still in detention. The elders of the church, those that run the church, a couple of them are still in detention. A couple of others have been released but are under house arrest. Well, I don't know if they'll jail them formally, arrest them and try them, but they could be put under house arrest. There's been precedent for this before where people are essentially held under house arrest for years and years.
By one account, more than 100,000 Chinese Christians have been detained this year, more than three times as many as last year.
Yes, this is part of the overall crackdown on religious groups that the government is worried about. The government sees some religions as potentially useful allies. In a way, you could think of it as analogous to Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he's embraced the Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox Church, to some degree, has embraced Putin, and it's sort of a pillar of his support. The Chinese Communist Party, although it's called a Communist Party, it's supposed to be atheist. In fact, it's sort of similar to Putin's Russia in that it sees some religions like Buddhism, Taoism, folk religions as being useful, and other religions like Christianity and Islam as more problematic, potential enemies or challengers, and so they're going hard after these groups.
Ian Johnson said the crackdown has been far more severe in rest of northwest Xinjiang territory, where more than a million ethnic Muslims holding what are called strong religious views have been sent to so-called re-education camps, prompting international calls for access to them. China said the camps protect the country from terrorism while providing vocational training. Thank you. The sale of Nile perch fish maw in Uganda has become a lucrative business, especially for distributors. The fish maw, or dried swim bladder, is used as an aphrodisiac in China. But Ugandan fishermen bringing in the perch say they're being exploited, while others are reaping the profits. Atumani Halima reports from Kampala.
Idris Awalusimbi began working as a fisherman 20 years ago. Now he has his own boat and is chairman of the Fish Protection Unit. He recalls when mostly locals enjoyed the Nile perch fish maw, but now much of it is exported to China, where it's considered an aphrodisiac. Olusimbi says fish maw prices have jumped, but fishermen see little of the profit.
You find that from the lowest fisherman, as you know, that he gains, but not so much. Then you find the middleman gains more, and the trader above gains even more.
A study by the Lake Victoria Fisheries Organization says the growing appetite in Asia for the swim bladder, once viewed as a waste byproduct, has created a multi-million dollar export business. Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda earn $86 million US. Uganda accounting for nearly half of the sales, making it the largest exporter of fish maw to China in 2017.
That's why we want to regulate it, so that our fish farmers and, of course, the fishmongers and the fisheries sector really benefit from this very lucrative business.
International prices of dry maw range between $450 and $1,000 per kilogram, depending on the size, quality, and market strength.
We have always known that it's a saleable commodity, but we sell it at low prices, so we have been exploited.
Fishermen sell it for lower prices to locals without the swim bladders, but fish processors want the entire fish. The Lake Victoria Fish Organization suggests fish maw be recognized as a commodity separate from fish. The Ugandan government is working to craft regulations for fish maw products. Athmani Halima for VOA News, Kampala.
Humanity's efforts to move into and peer into space seem to be experiencing something of a renaissance over the past few weeks. NASA's pictures of Ultima Thule continue to astound, as do Chinese pictures from their probe on the far side of the moon. VOA's Kevin Enix told us coming soon the James Webb Telescope will allow NASA to look even farther into the great beyond.
The James Webb Telescope is being prepped for launch in 2021, and it will change the way that NASA views the universe.
James Webb is designed specifically to look into the infrared, and this is an area of the spectrum where we have looked before, but certainly never with anything as advanced as Webb. So the hope is that we're really going to expand what we understand about the universe in this regime.
The infrared spectrum not only allows astronomers to see things the human eye can't, but infrared waves are special in that they don't scatter as much as visible light does when passing through interstellar gas and dust. So the Webb telescope will see farther and better.
Webb is designed to observe the universe in the infrared, and by doing that, you open up a tremendous amount of new science that we can do. Two of the extremes are looking, first of all, at the most distant galaxies in the universe. Their light, because of the effect of cosmological redshift, is shifted all the way into the infrared. So we're only really able to observe those galaxies by looking in the infrared.
It's also just a much better telescope than Hubble, which has been in orbit since 1990.
It's a much larger mirror than Hubble, so it's five times larger in area than Hubble. It's also located at a much better place to actually put a telescope, so well beyond the orbit of the Earth. And this allows it, again, to see fainter objects. And in the intervening time, we've developed better instrumentation, so better cameras.
And it's just possible that the Webb telescope might be the tool that helps astronomers prove that we're not alone in the universe.
It's not really what Webb is designed to do, but part of Webb's mission is to find planets and to study their atmospheres. Now, there's possibilities that we might actually discover evidence or indirect evidence for life on these planets by looking at the chemistry in their atmospheres.
The telescope is scheduled to be launched in 2021 and will be deployed about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
It's been 51 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the African-American preacher who led a civil rights movement that changed the nation and reverberated around the world. Since then, America has made great strides on race, but deep divisions still remain. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo gives us a look at the African-American and African immigrant experience when it comes to race in America today.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up.
August 29, 1963. It was a speech that galvanized a nation and put civil rights and economic justice at the forefront of the American conversation. Race, media, and communication professor from American University, Sherry Williams.
What he was really trying to do was achieve racial equality, and not just racial equality, but also economic justice. We know that right before he died, he was working on the Poor People's Campaign, and he was in Memphis working with sanitation workers who were on strike, who were basically just striving for a living wage.
Howard University's Greg Carr says while there has been some progress, economic disparities still exist.
If we look at Black America generally, economically, a Black family in this country, the median wealth of Black households, for every dollar that a white household has, a Black household in this country has about 10 cents. One-tenth of the wealth of an average white household is in a Black household. That's absurd.
But the current relatively strong U.S. economy has boosted the job market for all races. The unemployment rate for Blacks fell below 6% last year, the lowest since 1972. Still, according to a recent Harvard University study, half of all Black Americans report experiencing discrimination in the workplace. Police brutality in predominantly African American communities is another source of concern.
No justice!
The Black Lives Matter movement that surfaced in 2014 after the shooting in the state of Missouri of a Black man by a white police officer has taken up that cause.
They open our eyes to everything. They help us understand that while we may not be seen as human or powerful currently, that the fruits of our labor will soon come.
Being Black in America has certainly changed since the famous Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream speech. America twice voted for an African-American president in 2008 and again in 2012. But improving race relations, as evidenced by a recent resurgence of white supremacy groups, have quite a ways to go. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
One of the some 20 undeclared ballistic missile operating bases in North Korea serves as a missile headquarters. That is part of the findings of a new report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The report says the Sino-Ri missile operating base and the Nodong missiles deployed at this location fit into North Korea's presumed nuclear military strategy by providing an operational-level nuclear or conventional first-strike capability. The discovery of an undeclared missile headquarters came 3 days after U.S. President Donald Trump announced last Friday that he looks forward to another summit to discuss denuclearization with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February. I spoke via Skype about the report with Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Well, I don't think that the discovery of the missile base, while it's new news, it's an old story. There's been no effort by the North Koreans to disclose or identify where their nuclear and their missile capabilities lie. So this is not a I don't think it's a new piece of information that suddenly clouds the meeting. This is the reality of the situation. The U.S. North Korea discussion at the head of government level is very preliminary. It has not even got to the basics yet of exactly what can be revealed, what can't be revealed, much less than how things are going to start being removed.
What kind of effect might that have on the next summit meeting if it is to take place?
It would be difficult to imagine this stopping the meeting, because both sides have known that this has not yet been part of even an agreement on the declaration of facilities. It underlines how difficult this next summit meeting is going to be, on the basis of there having been very little progress on any of the inferred actions by North Korea, and the United States still not winding down the sanctions. So it's almost as if we're in a time warp where we're going back as if it's a first meeting that didn't cover some ground. Whether it can or not, the odds are not very high that something breakthrough is going to come here, but hope springs eternal.
Given that, what does either side, or both sides for that matter, want to get out of this meeting?
Well, I think that the politics for both sides are important. Mr. Trump is trying to move ahead with a special initiative in his own special way that he hopes will produce some kind of result. I think the more interesting logic is right now on the North Korean side. And as before earlier meetings, this is being accompanied by a series of interactions with South Korea, but particularly with China. So whether under those circumstances, North Korean, President Kim is going to come with any new kinds of proposals is in question. I think, you know, we can't distance this from the U.S.-China economic negotiations. I mean, Xi Jinping is in many ways in the middle of both a difficult negotiation with the United States on trade, but he is also the broker. He's the person who can have at least some influence on what Kim is willing to put on that table. And so this could be a desire to stall for time, to let this thing run later, to see where the U.S.-China negotiations go. Or he may see some help Kim take some steps towards keeping the process in play with the U.S.
How much input do you think Xi Jinping has had already, given the last meeting between he and Kim just a week or two ago?
Well, it's correct that the North Koreans are not moving very far without consultations, obviously, with Xi. And whether that is going to produce leverage to move forward, or whether it's going to be a delay and keep the status quo, the murky status quo, indefinitely. I think, you know, the other factor that has come into play in this is that if we imagine four musicians trying to play a quartet, we have essentially North Korea, China, and increasingly South Korea playing to one kind of melody, whereas the United States is something on the outside. It has the biggest instrument, but it is listening, and it is not in it. It's not the deciding. It's not the lead instrument in this quartet going forward, and that's what makes all of this so peculiar. Is that you have three countries going in one kind of direction on this, and the U.S. Both divided and not moving forward in its ambitions.
Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. A nearly century-long lease on a new port and struggling herbal medicine shops were the topics of last week's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
China is building a huge port city in Sri Lanka on land reclaimed from the sea. The $1.4 billion project is being co-developed by the Sri Lankan government as part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. It is Sri Lanka's largest single direct foreign investment. Alexi Gunasekera is the commercial counselor for the Sri Lankan embassy.
The marina bay that will be developed in the port city will attract the affluent tourists to Sri Lanka. India also will get the benefit. The entire region will get the benefit, yes, of that tourism sector. So I think this port city is not only for Sri Lanka, it's for the entire region and for entire South Asia.
Almost half of the reclaimed land will be handed over to China on a 99-year lease, after which it will revert back to Sri Lankan ownership. Many have criticized the deal, saying China is pulling Sri Lanka into a debt trap. But not everyone sees it that way. Gao Zikai is the vice president for the Center for China and Globalization.
Sri Lanka is a fully independent and sovereign country, and there is no infringement or violation of any of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Sri Lanka.
The reclamation part of the Port City project was completed last week. Phase two will involve the construction of housing, marinas, roads, and other infrastructure projects. Chinese herbal medicine shops in Taiwan are struggling to survive because of a quirk in Taiwanese law. Approximately 200 mom-and-pop dispensaries are closing their doors every year. Many Taiwanese still value the disappearing herbal remedy shops. Guo Chongfu is a second-generation herbal dispenser.
Chinese herbal medicine stores is a unique culture and icon in Taiwan. It is a very long tradition.
In the 1990s, authorities limited government licenses for dispensaries in an effort to regulate their businesses. Their hope was that professionally trained Chinese medicine doctors would take over the herbal stores. But the low pay failed to attract doctors and pharmacists. Authorities have not issued any new licenses since 1998, and those that do exist cannot be passed down to younger generations. Guo Chongfu.
When the Chinese medicine shops are forced to close because the second generation cannot carry on legally, our livelihood will be in jeopardy.
The license shortage has prompted protests on the streets of Taipei, and the government is in talks with industry leaders to find a way forward. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
The annual World Economic Forum has opened in Switzerland against a backdrop of anxieties over trade disputes, Brexit, and a growth slowdown that some fear could tip the world economy. More from VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Some 3,000 businesses, government, and ordinary citizens are meeting in the Swiss city of Davos this week. Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, says that strengthening global cooperation is a must for the world economy, which has experienced a slow and uneven recovery since the global financial crisis in 2008.
I think we are walking on relatively thin ice because as our global risk report, which we published some days ago, has shown, there are many threats to the global economy. I think it's very important to strengthen global cooperation. That's what we want to achieve here in Davos.
The WEF's own Global Risks Report set the tone this week with a stark warning of a looming economic downturn, in part because of geopolitical tensions among major powers. Several world leaders stayed away, including U.S. President Donald Trump, who's grappling with the country's longest government shutdown in U.S. history. But his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed anxieties over a trade dispute with China during a video conference.
There are those who say that conflict, superpower conflict between our two countries is inevitable. We don't see it that way. We want to find places where we can work together.
Pompeo stressed that cooperation between the two countries can only work if some conditions are met.
Free and open seas, the capacity for nations to take their goods around the world, fair and reciprocal trade arrangements where every country has the opportunity to compete on a fair, transparent, and open basis.
Another leader who didn't attend was British Prime Minister Theresa May, who survived a no-confidence vote after her Brexit withdrawal agreement was recently rejected, an issue of concern for this attendee.
I think if we get a hard Brexit, the consequences are such that it will be a major disruption, and I think it's very difficult to prepare for that. So we're really hoping for and banking on the fact that the people will come to their senses and that we will have regimes that will ensure that we can continue the way that we're doing today.
While economic growth is slowing, the aid charity Oxfam warned the Davos elite that income inequality around the world is not. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The trade war between the United States and China and the overall relationship between the two countries was one of the topics brought up this week when VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren spoke with Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States.
The current president of the United States has a trade war. He has tariffs on China. I take it that would not be the Carter diplomacy with China.
No, it wouldn't.
I thought so.
And I think since the summit meeting that we had in Argentina, I think they've made some progress. China has agreed to do two or three things. One is to buy more soybeans, and I think they've made two purchases of a major size of American soybeans. They've also promised to open up investment opportunities by American corporations in China. On things like intellectual rights and you know, copyrights to cover that, I'm not sure what progress they've made, but they've made some progress, and my hope is that the trade talks will improve the economies both in China and the United States. When we don't get along with China, it hurts both of us, not just us, not just China, but also it hurts the United States economically.
Are you optimistic about the relationship between the United States and China? Are we headed in a good direction?
I think in the long term, the American people will see that getting along well with China is a key to our own prosperity and our own peaceful life and our own good life. And I think we have a temporary maybe setback under President Trump, but I can't predict what the next president will do. But I'll continue to use my influence and the influence of the Carter Center to see that we treat China with respect. We deal with their with problems with China in an open fashion and be honest with both sides. And I think the Chinese are very likely to do the same.
Okay, how many times have you been to China?
Well, before I had my cancer scare a few years ago, I was going to China almost every year. But I don't know how many times I've been, but
do you love China? I mean, because you travel there so much.
Well, I do. In fact, the first time I went to China was on a submarine in 1949. Probably before you were born. But
not
anyway.
Much before I was born, but a little bit.
Well, a little bit before you were born. Anyway, so it was right after that the People's Republic of China was formed and the communists took over. And so it happened to be on my birthday, which Deng Xiaoping thought was significant, October 1st, 1949. I was 25 years old, so I'm 25 years older than the People's Republic of China. So I had a long time interest in China.
It's fascinating to watch China because China is doing all these business deals all over the world, some called debt diplomacy.
That was Deng Xiaoping's part of opening up. He was going to reform inside China and end the so-called isolation of China in dealing with the outside world. And I think now we have seen that diplomatically and with trade and investments and also benevolent causes, China has reached out as much as possible to have good relationships with countries all over the world, which they avoided for a long time before 1979.
Mr. President, nice to talk to you. And, of course, it's particularly fascinating because this is such a monumental time in history, for, you know, the normalization of relations, because even in my time, when I was growing up, it seemed impossible.
Well, it seemed impossible to a lot of people. And it had to be done, as I said earlier in the interview, very secretly, because we had a lot of people who were opposed to it. The Republican Party was opposed to it. A lot of the business interests that were dealing with Taiwan were opposed to it. And many people in the State Department were opposed to it. So I decided to do it, and I was successful in doing it. And because of Deng Xiaoping's, I'd say, generosity and his openness and his attractiveness as a human being, it was accepted okay by the American people.
You can see Greta's complete interview with President Carter on her Plugged In program. You can find it at voanews.com. In the future, a tattoo may not only be a way for someone to express themselves, it may also be used to monitor a genetic condition or even control a prosthetic device. More from VOA's Kevin Enox.
It's estimated that about 1 in 5 people around the world have a tattoo. But researchers in Portugal are making tattoos that are more about science than body art.
For the first time, we have created a method that allows us inkjet printing of highly stretchable electronic skin that can be transferred to the human skin, similar to the kids' temporary tattoos.
The tattoo is printed, then covered with a liquid metal alloy that conducts electricity. It's immersed in water, then applied to the skin, just like a temporary tattoo. It's cheap and easy.
What's new in our method is the fabrication technology, because previous methods for fabrication of stretchable electronics were costly, labor-intensive, and complex.
Once applied to the skin, it can read or send electric signals. This could be a great leap forward in treating people with diseases that affect their nervous system.
We place these tattoos over the skin. Then we can stimulate muscles or nerves. This can be useful for some patient conditions with neurological disorders. For instance, people with spinal cord injuries would be able to walk again.
It also could help amputees manipulate their prosthetics by acting as artificial nerve tissue.
Healthcare is the application we're really focused on. Another area of my lab is focused on more generally human-machine interaction and soft robotics. And so these materials, like I said before, also have applications as artificial skin and artificial nervous tissues.
And since the application is temporary, getting one is way less painful than getting a real tattoo. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
For over 50 years, Oscar-winning filmmaker and actor Clint Eastwood has portrayed tough characters, bounty hunters, police detectives, and macho heartthrobs. In his latest movie, The Mule, the octogenarian now softens his masculine persona to interpret a frail old man whose financial hardship forces him to take up a job as a drug courier or a mule for a Mexican drug cartel. VOA's Penelope Pulu delivered the story.
Oh. Need help, sir?
Oh, officer, hi.
You need help?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
What do you got there?
Pecans. Delivering pecans to my niece.
Pecans? Syrup.
Yeah, pecans. She makes the worst pecan pie you've ever tasted.
No cop would suspect that Earl Stone is trafficking drugs. An old, upright, white man, Stone is above suspicion. But despite his quiet demeanor, Stone is resilient and the cartel's top mule, transporting millions of dollars worth of cocaine. A seasoned traveler who spent his career driving around the country as a horticulturalist, he knows how to navigate the American road system. He is never stopped for traffic violations and operates under the DEA agents' noses, even when he crosses paths with top agent Colin Bates, bent on capturing the elusive mule no one has ever seen, but everyone is talking about.
You gotta think about family.
Yeah.
Anniversary is important. But you know, I'm the king of missing anniversaries. That's
oh, yeah?
The problem, yes.
Oh, it's the first one I've missed. So.
So good luck. Don't follow my footsteps and do what I did. I put work in front of family. And this is the most important thing.
Bradley Cooper plays Officer Bates. He describes Eastwood's character.
It's a man on a path, reckoning his past, reckoning for his what he making up for mistakes, making peace with himself. But it's a reckoning for how he's lived his life.
Stone's financial troubles and his desire to make up for past mistakes and lost chances with his estranged wife and daughter lies at the heart of the story. Broke and rejected by his family, he takes a job as a drug mule, not out of greed, at least in the beginning, but out of despair to make things right. And though that is part of the film narrative, in some way, it reflects Eastwood's real life. Iris, his estranged on-screen daughter, is played by his real daughter, Allison Eastwood, who says she did not always have the best relationship with her dad.
It's been challenging because I do have such a great relationship with my dad these days, so I've had to sort of go back and dig around in the past when I might have not been so happy with him and bring that up as an actor, you know, because this character is really angry.
As Stone makes up for lost time with his family, he's running out of time with the law. DEA agents are on his trail, and the cartel tightens its control over him, even as he is determined to keep his own timetable on the road. His illicit income is becoming more and more visible as he spreads money around.
He almost becomes like a Robin Hood character because he makes all this money unlawfully. But he goes around and starts helping people that need things.
But despite Eastwood's romantic spin on his stint as a drug mule, critics say the film glosses over the criminality of drug trafficking and the devastating effects of drugs and drug cartels on society. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
We appreciate your attendance this week for VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.